Hi, I'm Elise.
I'm Matt, and welcome to Pod Wraiths, a Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast. If this is your first time joining us, we're two friends watching Star Trek Deep Space Nine and sharing both our deep and irreverent thoughts on our favorite Star Trek series.
This week, we're talking about Season 5, Episode 13, For the Uniform, teleplay by Peter Allen Fields and directed by Victor Lobel. For the Uniform aired on February 3rd, 1997.
This week on Deep Space Nine, Sisko obsessively pursues Maquis leader Michael Eddington.
I was just going to say, this episode was a bit surreal for 2024 for me.
Did you remember it before rewatching it?
Or? Not really. Like, I knew like there was another episode with, at least another episode with Michael Eddington, but I didn't like remember what happened in it.
Yeah, and like in some ways I do like, again, this is like a sequel to the season 4 episode For the Cause, which was where, you know, we find out that Eddington was a secret Maquis and, you know, betrays them and whatever. So then here's like the duality, here's the one, it's For the Cause versus the Uniform, really like from Eddington's perspective, now to Sisko's perspective, which really both episodes could just be called For the Ego, or For the Main Characters in Parts 1 and 2.
So there will be actually a third episode later this season called Blaze of Glory, and I think that's where the Michael Eddington arc concludes. And I'm just, like, kind of laughing that at the title, because I don't remember what happens in that one. So it'll be interesting to see, like, who's centered in that episode.
Yeah, we're so close that it's fine.
Yeah, it's in 10 episodes. We'll be good.
Yeah. It's, and I mean, I think coming on pretty quickly, people can probably assume based on context clues. So you said this felt a little bit too real in 2024. Can you tell me more?
I mean, we have a section. It's just like mostly I have this later in my notes, like, to discuss the Maquis a little bit, but, like, for at the beginning...
Yeah, no, we can
yeah, it's it for then, though. It's related to, like, this... At the beginning of the episode where Eddington's, like, explaining to Sisko, like, what the Maquis is fighting for, just felt very relevant to what's happening in Gaza right now. In the show, right, the DMZ was created because of a peace treaty, and people were displaced from their homes, and that is just, like, what happened in Gaza, you know, after World War II. Yeah. You know, people know the history of that, so I'm not going to give, like, a history lesson, but, like, it does feel very similar, and I was, like, slightly worried that the episode would be a little too heavy for me, and, like, it wasn't until the end again. Like, so, like, the middle of this episode, I was, like, okay, if this is just about, like,
yeah, just a Sisko, submarine movie.
Yeah,
it's
like if, exactly. Exactly. That, yeah. And we all know I love a Tom Clancy-esque naval submarine movie. Like, that is something I love. So I was like, okay, I can vibe with this. And then the end happens, and I was like, oh, God. Like, this is just so upsetting. But at the same time, like, I liked this episode. I don't like how it ends or what happens at the end, but I just found it super interesting. Like, it's complicated. You know, sometimes our favorites make decisions that we think are very shitty.
To put it in Friends parlance, this episode could really be called... what did they start? No, the one where the one where the gang does war crimes.
That's more It's Always Sunny.
The title of It's Always Sunny, but yeah.
But I mean, the one with is a Friends formatting of title for sure. But yeah,
I just combined them.
You did.
That's where you go.
But like the gang does a war crime, like feels very It's Always Sunny. Yeah,
very sunny.
I just also wanted to mention...
That's pretty much your life now, though, that you live where you live in, like, greater Philadelphia, though, right?
I mean, I surround myself with much less shittier people than the gang from It's Always Sunny. But, yeah, I mean, sure. I leave my house.
Can I offer you an egg in this trying time?
So you guys... You guys being the listeners may remember Peter Allen Fields' name from earlier from earlier seasons of Deep Space Nine. He was a producer on the first season and like did a lot in the first two seasons writing wise. He had retired from television when he wrote this episode. So I think it's interesting. I didn't get to read like how they got him to do this or like if he had the idea and came to them. Like, I don't know what the scenario was, but I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, and there'll be a future episode in coming seasons. Folks might have heard of kind of Through the Ether in the Pale Moonlight, yes. Which was also written by Peter.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense.
Right? Yeah. So
I don't want to spoil that for people that haven't listened to it yet, but there are similar complicated things going on in that episode.
Yep. But yeah, just to like, I guess, go back and talk about the Machina a little more.
Yes.
That the opening, the teaser or whatever, where, you know, Sisko's looking for, is basically in the refugee camp and is looking for intel in Eddington, and we find out that it's actually Eddington there, and you know, they did some stuff to the informant or
whatever. He's not dead. He's just on a planet that's basically uninhabitable. Like, okay, so he's getting a slow death. Like, real nice, guys.
Yeah, right? But yeah, I just, like, Sisko's, like, walking through there. It's just, like, extremely fucked up to me that Star Trek is ostensibly this, like, supposed to be this, like, post-scarcity society, right? And then you have folks that are living like that.
It's, like, post-scarcity just, like, for me, not you.
Right? And it's like post-scarcity, like, you know, as long as, you know, you agree with, like, Federation policy and, like, whatever. As long as you have certain politics, then, yeah, cool, come and have replicators and shit.
Right.
And it just, unfortunately, you talk about this episode being, like, all too real. It's really not that different, I suppose, from, you know, the conditions that, you know, settler colonialism and capitalism have inflicted on our neighbors in the community, right? Like, I live downtown. There are, you know, houseless folks in the community and things like that. And it's like, yeah, it's fucked up that you can have, you know, homeless folks or houseless folks being displaced by, you know, the hockey arena that has billionaire owners, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's, I guess it's the same type of contradiction, right? So
I remember when they rebuilt Yankee Stadium, or, like, I think that a lot of people...
The new one? Built the new one?
Yeah, I feel like a lot of people got... I don't remember if it was that one or Citi Field, excuse me, which, like, where the Mets play. But I feel like I remember reading about a lot of people getting, like, displaced for those buildings. Because, like, it wasn't, like, let's tear down... I think at least for Yankee Stadium, it wasn't like, let's tear down the current one and put the same, like, put it in the same place. It was like, we need to make money, so we will continue using the old Yankee Stadium until, and I say the old Yankee Stadium, like, that was a newer Yankee Stadium, that wasn't the original one, so I think this is, like, the third Yankee Stadium. But it's like, we have to make money selling tickets and whatever while this other building is being built, so it's kind of just shitty. I do want to say, like, in general, it's extremely hard for me to not be sympathetic. I'm just gonna say it without saying a double negative. It's very easy for me to be sympathetic to the Maquis. If they weren't a sympathetic group, Star Trek Voyager as a show just would not work at all. Like, we would be like, why are you teaming up with these people? Like, it makes no sense. But I do think that their methods are not, like, 100% great. I don't like that they poisoned a bunch of Cardassians and had to make them, like, leave. That is, like, not great either. But I don't think that...
Two things can be true at once, right?
Yeah, like, I'm not saying, like, the Cardassians being on those planets is good, you know?
Yeah.
But I am not much more critical of, like... like, everyone that's not the Maquis in this crew, in this episode. Like, I'm much more critical of everyone else.
Yeah, like the people bombing civilians. Or poisoning planets, which I guess they're both doing. So we're just supposed to say it's a equivalency and it's fine. But now I'm getting ahead of myself.
Yeah.
What I thought was interesting.
Yes.
Go ahead.
No, you.
What I thought was interesting too is like the idea of this episode establishing like timelines related to other episodes. Cause right. And again, we see the, even in kind of, I guess, following up a little bit too, we see the show, I was going to say edging more and more. And then I said, edging. I am a 13-year-old boy. Flirting more and more, transitioning more and more, to serialization. As you know, it's like, okay, it's been 8 months since For the Cause. Okay, it's been 18 months since, you know, The Search Part 1 and 2, and we're introduced to Eddington, and we get The Defiant, and, like, all of that. So I thought that was again, pretty minor in the scheme of, like, discussion points for this episode. But I thought that was interesting. Yeah, and it's just, again, like, kind of said how it could, this episode, both parts of this duology, if you will, could just be called like For the Ego or For the Main Character Syndrome. Like, yeah, it's not great that the Maki, unlike, you know, it's not great that both of our like two-handers at Eddington and Cisco basically poisoned planets so the people living there would find it uninhabitable, and then the Cardassians and the humans would just switch planets because it was habitable to them.
Yeah, like that seems like a waste of energy for everyone. Like, right? What does it matter if this population is on this planet and this population is on? Like, switching them doesn't seem like better than what it is currently.
No, and let's just, we're heroes are in the eye of the beholder, right? Like, both Eddington and Cisco see themselves as the hero, and when we're our hero, we're justified in our actions, like, especially when we're not, right? And like, yeah, what allows, and maybe we can, like, you know, following the notes, kind of get into the analogies and stuff here, but like, there's a lot made in the end of like Cisco embracing the role of villain.
Right.
But really, he's just matching what Eddington has already done, and Eddington sees himself as the hero, so there is an interesting duality there, right?
Yeah, so this gets mentioned pretty heavily in the episode. Eddington brings up Les Mis, and it's been 20 years at least since I've seen a production of Les Mis. I think I saw it on Broadway in high school, and I graduated high school 24 years ago, so it's been some time. So I don't really remember who is the main character of that story, but I did find this a very interesting analogy. Eddington thinking that he was Valjean feels really on point to me. I would say that Valjean's crime is a little less severe than what happened in this episode, but that's not really the point. It is about people thinking they are the hero, and I think that's, you've already covered that pretty well, so I will just say I agree, and I think that was a great point.
Yeah, it's one thing, just Eddington seeing himself as Jean Valjean is just... Oh boy, you're right. Jean Valjean was in prison because he stole a loaf of bread to feed his nephew, I believe it was.
Right.
And then he escapes, and Javert, the villain, mm-hmm. who Cisco gets compared to, you know, he's kind of like Walter in The Big Lebowski, you know, when Walter's like, am I the one who cares about the fucking rules? That's also Javert's impulse. And then it leads to, like, the part of the, like, the thing is, and it, Eddington says this, it drives him to suicide. But, like, his pursuit of Valjean is what ultimately, like, leads to his downfall. But they're both Valjean and they're both Javert, like, in their own ways. Like, that's the complexity and the moral thorniness of, like, human existence, right? And so to just simplify and flatten it is, it's interesting, but, like, again, you dig a little bit deeper, scratch under the surface, and it's, like, totally an imagined thing. But I will say that after you play the long game and basically unleash your virus so you can get away from the ship you used to work on, and then sending a copy of Les Miserables, of an ebook, to Cisco to make and find your point was my kind of.
Do you think he had to send him like a specific pad of just that book because they don't know how to like do more than one program on a pad still?
Well, it's, you could download it to one pad from the greater computer bank, I guess.
Just to give to a little bit further away from the analogy and more just to the hunt for Eddington in general, it's been said in the episode, and you mentioned this with the timing between the different episodes, Cisco's been trying to catch Eddington for 8 months now, and it's gotten to the point where Starfleet actually like decides Eddington knows too much about you, Ben, like we need someone else to try to catch him. And this is a part of the episode I actually found really interesting because I really love the trope of like someone, because I'm a mystery story enjoyer, like that is something I like. So the idea of someone being like taken off the case but actually not stopping the like hunt or trying to figure out the mystery is something I find very fun. Like, you're too obsessed, you cannot let it go. They often do get their
man. Your badge and gun.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I like that.
There's also lots of good, like, talking about the hunt and stuff itself, and we kind of referenced it a little bit before, but there's lots of good, like, submarine shit.
Yeah.
Like, Defiant shit. And, like, when I think Star Trek, like, whether it's ship combat or, you know, just kind of Star Trek ship stuff in general, is when it really leans into, like, those naval tropes and things like that. So whether it's, you know, submarine or, you know, part of, I think, of why some of the ship combat and things like that in The Wrath of Khan work so well is Nicholas Meyer was like, oh, this is, it's the Horatio Hornblower.
Yeah,
it's like,
I rewatched that recently. Yeah,
it's
so
like
the big
naval tall ships, right? So,
yeah, this might be my favorite part of the episode when they were having to use the Defiant with limited function. Obviously, they like kind of stole the Defiant, really, because they did not have permission to continue searching for Eddington. And the Defiant was damaged previously, so they don't really have like comms. They don't have like the normal, like everything's just having to be done manually. And I thought it was cool that part of this idea came as an homage to the Robert Wise film, Run Silent, Run Deep. Robert Wise also directed Star Trek The Motion Picture, and I will just say he's one of my dad's favorite directors. He did West Side Story and a bunch of Sound of Music, like a bunch of other big films. I do love the use of Nog here. Nog is in Starfleet and has excellent hearing because he's Ferengi. And so it makes sense to enlist him to be the communicator between the different departments on the Defiant. And he's like literally on like a what looks like to be a phone. Everyone has to be extremely specific of what they're doing and what's happening at their station. And as you said, it just feels very much like a naval submarine situation. I always enjoy like a, ooh, we have to go back to basics, like old school trope. Like that's always a lot of fun. They all felt like they were communicating.
I'm going to have to rewatch Hunt for Red October.
Yeah, this kind of made me think the same thing. Like maybe I'll watch it like as soon as we're done podcasting. Like that would be really fun. But yeah, I just really enjoyed watching everyone have to like overly communicate with each other also. Like there was a lot more talking in this episode than there normally is.
So we've kind of referenced it before, but do you want to dig into like the climax and stuff?
Yeah, so I mean, this is the kind of episode that has a lot of themes and things that come up that felt very much in the spirit of this podcast, not trying to go plot by plot or like plot beat by beat as to explain like what happens. This episode feels more about like the consequences of people's actions and, you know, how they make these decisions. So I basically devoted an entire section to Cisco does a war crime. Basically, Cisco says, I'm going to poison these planets so humans can't live there, after Eddington's group did the same for about regarding Cardassians. There's a scene where Eddington is telling Sisko that he's going against everything he believes in, but does not realize it. And I'm just, that is something I was thinking the entire time, but I also think, like, Eddington, like, that's true for you as well. Yeah. I really had a hard time with, like, Worf especially going through with this. Like, I'm mad at all of them. Like,
well, and you see the hesitation in Worf's face.
He knows this is not honorable. Like, he doesn't say that, but you could read that on his face. I didn't remember that this happened. So the entire time we're seeing this, like, scene, it's kind of like this tense scene between the two of them. I really wanted to believe that Sisko was bluffing about this. I didn't think he would poison a bunch of people, or, like, maybe he was faking it, like, on the view screen. Like, they, like, had, like, a, you know, like, because Eddington was, like, I was really confused about how Eddington was, like, was he, like, projecting himself there? Like, he had some, like, fancy thing, or was he physically there in the
arm? Yeah, so what they, this is the first use and mention of, I can't remember what they call it.
It's like a hollow something.
Instead of using,
like, a hollow communicator,
yeah,
or something.
Instead of using, yeah, so basically instead of using the view screen, everyone has that little, like, you know, you can see that there's that bar or whatever around the floor, so it's like
it,
how they communicate in Star
Wars.
Yeah,
I was gonna just say, like, the same thing, although it looks a little bit more realistic here. Like, it looks like it's obviously, yeah, like, just the person is standing there.
Yeah,
but yeah, so, like,
and, like, sorry, go ahead.
I was gonna say, if he was physically there, then it would be easy to fool him, but I guess, like, thinking about it now, like, the fact that he wasn't actually on the Defiant with them, like, he would have probably known that it wasn't happening if it wasn't happening.
Yeah. And, like, this hollow, the hollow floor emitter thing only gets used one more time in a couple episodes and then is never heard from again.
Yeah, it didn't look familiar to me. Like, I didn't remember having seen it before.
Yeah. So, and it's, like, I'll almost, like, it's kind of weird, but, like, almost allow it, because I don't think if you had just had, and I mean, okay, I guess it worked for Wrath of Khan, because, like, Kirk and Khan never actually are in the same room. They're talking to each other on the view screen right the whole time. But I do, I did, you could get them playing off each other a little bit differently.
Yes.
With this, by physically having Eddington there.
Yeah, yeah.
Air quotes physically, but having the actor there.
I think it was cool. It just, like, confused me, and I kept forgetting he wasn't actually there.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, it's just kind of as a brief aside, this was, like, something that Ron Moore had been pushing for, because he thought that we're the 21st century. Why are we still talking to each other TV screens?
He has a really good point. Yeah.
But the special effects people hated it. They thought it was dumb. And they're like, it's too difficult, like, to shoot, because TV is a 2D medium,
right,
and blah, 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 blah. And they're like, the whole reason that Gene had the view screen thing to begin with was to save time and money. So I think that's probably,
yeah, I mean, pretty cool. I will say that I thought it looked really cool. Like, I thought they did a good job with it. But yeah, if it's too much work, I understand not wanting to continue doing that.
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
and even, like, and I know it's just one of the stupid things that people would, like, complain about for Star Trek Discovery Season 1. But, like, they had that kind of version of that on their bridges. And now on Strange New Worlds, they just talk on the view screen.
Yeah, for sure. I just finished my rewatch of Discovery Season 4, so I'm finally going to start Season 5 soon. I'm very excited about that. I wanted to say the biggest, besides wanting them to have, like, been faking out about this poisoning, I really was bothered by the last bit of the episode where Dax and Ben are, like, coming off of the Defiant and joking about this. Like, sometimes it's good when the bad guys win. And I'm just like, oh, I guess I forgot to ask for permission to do this too. Like, none of that is funny. It was, it felt really in poor taste to me. I just, I didn't like it. I do want to comment on, like, the decision to have this happen in the episode. I do have a quote. I have a quote that I got from, it's Ronald D. Moore speaking in a magazine that was called Cinefantastique. I don't know if it's still in publication. It's kind of about how Sisko acted in comparison to how Picard or Kirk would have acted in a similar situation. And so I'm going to read this. So this is Ronald D. Moore. I don't know what year he said this either, so apologies. Now we've stirred it up and let people really argue about this. Sisko took an action and took a step that probably Picard wouldn't have. That's what made it an interesting episode. I could see Kirk taking this action. It seemed to me like what Sisko did was basically level the playing field again. Eddington goes and poisons some worlds, put some stuff in the atmosphere that makes the Cardassians have to leave. He didn't destroy the ecosystem or the biosphere because he wanted the worlds for the Maquis. Sisko just did the same thing, but did it to the Maquis, rendered some worlds uninhabitable to human life. It was a pretty drastic action. He's out on the frontier. He has some difficult decisions to make, and it solved the problem. He pulled Eddington in off his ship and got results. I respected him for doing it. It was a bold decision and it worked. I think the characters have to do the right thing, even if it's difficult, and make a tough decision and not worry so much about keeping their hands clean and not be so obsessed about what the rules are sometimes. I think that Kirk was more than willing to bend a rule every once in a while and serve the greater good. I think that's what Sisko did. I have a really, really hard time with this quote because there are levels of breaking the rules. Let's help this planet, even though it's against General Order 1 or the Prime Directive, is like a fine rule to break once in a while. This just feels like a completely different level that to me doesn't feel like a right thing at all. And I think that there's a difference between making a decision that doesn't keep your hands clean and like actually like having to displace people. Like, that is just so severe. It just goes over a line for me. I don't like it.
Yeah. It's, I get like from a narrative writer standpoint what Moore is saying here, and I don't disagree. And I don't know if I fully agree that like Kirk would do this exactly. I do think there was an interesting build up to Sisko making that choice because Eddington plays Sisko's morality against him a couple times, like, you know, rescuing the other ship and all these other things, or rescuing the Cardassian freighter. Like, Eddington knows that Sisko will do the right thing, and he uses mm-hmm. that to his advantage.
Yeah. I also think that, like, Kirk was very interested in the fact that he did not believe in, like, no-win situations and stuff. And I think that, I just think he would have come up with a different way to get Eddington than to, like, poison a bunch of people. Like, I just don't think that that is, I think about Kirk's, I agree that Picard would not have done this. But I don't think Kirk would have either.
So Sisko uses, or sorry, excuse me, Eddington uses the fact that Sisko's generally speaking a moral person to his advantage. And that's what leads to Sisko making the decision that I think we both don't agree with. But even doing war crimes of your own, like faking distress signals and everything else, that doesn't make Eddington the hero that he thinks he is. And yeah, I just think it's, we hold our captains in such, and rightfully so, in such high self-esteem. I just, off pod, we are talking about the current season of House of the Dragon. And a big point in that is when it's justified or not justified to use the nuclear deterrent of the dragons. And this just feels a little bit like that, where it's like, well, they did this damage to the planet, so we're justified in doing that. And it's like, no, you can be better. You can find a different way. But here we are.
Yeah, and I said this, but we had a couple technical issues, so I don't know if it got was in order. But I do think that because Kirk is so interested in always winning, I guess, is a better way to phrase that. Yeah. I do think he would have come up with a better way to get Eddington and handle all of this. And he would probably not have poisoned people. Like, I do think Picard definitely would not have done this. But, like, I don't really don't think Kirk would have either, to comment on Ronald Moore's quote.
And, I mean, we're not a TOS or, you know, Star Trek film podcast, generally speaking. So I don't need to go too far down this rabbit hole. But I just feel like I need to remind everyone, Kirk is a giant fucking nerd. Like, he is not... Yeah, he's a cool nerd, but he's still a nerd.
Like, Gary he's Mitchell, just like us.
In the second pilot, calls him, like, right? I'm kidding. Calls him a stack... In says at the Academy, he was a stack of books with legs. Like, he's very, to use Aesop, like, he's very, like, Aegon the Fifth coded. But... Yeah, he's not the space Lothario that people totally consider.
Yeah, I agree.
But anyways, that's a diatribe. That's a little tangent.
I think it's because he bangs so much that people forget he's nerdy. Because prior to...
Not like a regular
Well, I think like now being nerdy is like cool and in, but I don't think it used to be, so I think that confuses people. Did you have anything else to say on the larger episode before we get into our superlatives, as my other podcast host Tasia refers to the ending titles?
Two wrongs don't make a right, but it can be interesting to talk about.
Yes.
Now it's time for the Altair Water Thirst Quencher. Altair Water first being mentioned by Dr. McCoy in Star Trek III, The Search for Spock. There's only one Spock, just multiple actors play Spock in the movie. Anyways, also a possible reference to Alta from Altair 4 in the MGM film Forbidden Planet, also called Forbidden Planet, also called The Tempest in Space.
I think that everyone should watch that movie. I will say my friend, our buddy Jack watched it this week, and I just, like, I'm so excited about it. Like, young Leslie Nielsen and a robot, like, named Robbie. Like, what more could you want?
Well, and even if you haven't seen Forbidden Planet, if you're, like, vaguely in, like, the sci-fi genre, fantasy genre sphere, you have seen Robbie.
Oh, totally.
More than likely.
Mm-hmm. They
not even knowing where he's from.
Yeah, there's also, I forget what it's called, the boy who something. There was, like, a little TV movie episode where they just, like, there was some time travel. Like, there was, like, a computer thing, and this computer made, like, this boy do some weird shit, and, like, Robbie the Robot was in there, and it has nothing to do with Forbidden Planet, but, like, they just wanted Robbie the Robot to, like, be in another
Robbie thing. Became, like, a celebrity.
I know.
Yeah. He was a celebrity.
He's so cute.
Are you anyways, who are you thirsting for this week, Elise?
I'm not thirsting for anyone in this. I'm thirsting for the, like, 2 seconds where Worf almost didn't help commit a war crime. For 2 seconds, he was hot, like, when he was like, I don't think I should be doing this. But that's about it.
I mean, yeah, it wasn't a particularly thirsty episode for me either, but there were a couple good, like, Dax being charming scenes.
Yeah, there were.
You know, but, you know, Dax gonna Dax, Jadzia gonna Jadzia.
Yes. She can Jadzia all over me, please.
I'm trying to think of a good transition, and I can't. So we'll just do a hard one. Now it's time for the most Star Trek thing. Elise, what's your nominee for the most Star Trek things about his episode?
Our friends commit a war crime without permission, and no punishment happens. What about you?
Not ever mentioned again. Yeah. Mine was a reference to classic literature.
The Secret Life of Walter Mitty.
Kind of a big plot point. Well, I was thinking Marlene
I'm
is.
I'm kidding.
But, you know, yeah.
That was a joke.
Yeah.
But yeah, like The Secret Life of Michael Eddington. Yeah, that's a good one, too. Star Trek loves literature. I mean, that's why we have so much Shakespeare in Star Trek's. The Treks of the Stars. Every time you said, now it's time for the last two segments, I started thinking about, like, the Mickey Mouse Club song. Like, now it's time to say goodbye. Like, it just, like, got stuck in my head, and I'm like,
M-I-C.
See you real soon.
K-E-Y.
Why? Because we like you.
M-O-U-S-E. I hope the casting director of the new Mickey Mouse Club was very well compensated.
There's a new Mickey Mouse Club?
Is that cast, man? No, in the 90s.
Oh,
like the one that had, like,
yeah.
Gosling,
yeah,
and
yeah,
Carrie,
yeah,
Russell,
yes,
and Justin Timberlake. And Brittany,
I know,
and
he, like, made all those people,
like,
famous. So. Crazy. If it wasn't for him, we would not have had,
crazy.
This is going to ruin the tour. What tour? The world tour. We wouldn't have gotten that. So thank you to that man. I assume it was a man.
Well, until next time, Elise, where can folks find more of you on the internet?
You can find me on Blue Sky, Letterboxd, and Storygraph at Chicken Tendi. That's T-E-N-D-I. You can find my other podcast, Fang Bangers Pod, on Blue Sky and Instagram at Fang Bangers Pod. That's bangers with a Z or Z. I've also recently guested on Friend of the Pod, Lazzy's other podcast, Asimov Cast. That's a lot of the word cast in a row, to discuss the films Highlander and Highlander 2. Highlander is out already, and I did that with also Melissa, Ryan, and Tessa were on that episode, and Highlander 2 was just me and Laz, but I don't think that one's out yet. It should be, it might be out by the time this comes out. And you?
Here we are, born to be kings, we're the princes of the universe. Sorry, every time you mention Highlander,
it's fine.
Like, I get Queen stuck
I
in my
feel
head.
Really disappointed in myself that I had not seen Highlander prior to this, and not because it's, like, a good movie, but because I love all those Queen songs, and I literally had no idea that they were written for a movie. Had no fucking clue, and I felt really stupid about it.
And here we are, we're the princes of the universe. Yeah, you can catch me on Blue Sky and Letterboxd at MattyHugh, M-A-T-T-Y-H-U-G-H. You can catch Elise and I together on Blue Sky and Instagram at PodWraiths. And you can also email us at PodWraiths@gmail.com.
Please remember to rate and review us on the podcasting system of your choice. Thank you again to our editor, Melissa, and DJ Empirical for our interstellar theme song.
And until next time, computer and program.
Bye.